Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, and we are pro-public education, which means that we are not pro-state aid for private schools, and we are pro-separation of church and state. That's us. And we'll get straight into our program because we've got a lot of very interesting news this week. First of all, our press release 1054, the government is still considering recommendations regarding charity sector, says the Treasurer. Off we go to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1054. Government still considering recommendations regarding charities sector, says Treasurer. In Australia, private religious schools are considered charities. This means that although they receive billions of dollars in taxpayer funding, they are exempt from paying taxation. Even the parents who pay fees can obtain deductions for both fees and donations to building funds. The tax office lists these taxes foregone under the term taxation expenditures. These amount to many more billions of dollars. These taxation arrangements explain the very obvious inequalities between the private and public sector in relation to their income, expenditure, and resources. The Australian Productivity Commission is not impressed with the current situation regarding these and other religious charities. Their key recommendations on religious charities include 1. Removing the concept of basic religious charities to apply consistent regulations to all charities. 2. Simplifying and harmonising state and territory charity laws. And 3. Enhancing the effectiveness of ancillary funds. The Commission also suggested increasing public information about charities and giving, which includes requiring public companies to report on their donations and enhancing the ACNC's public data on charities. But the Commonwealth Government is dragging its feet. According to Cy Gladman from The Rationalist, the Albanese government says it continues to consider the recommendations of an independent research and advisory body regarding reforms to the charity sector, including to religious charities, almost a year and a half since receiving them. In response to questions in the Senate on why the government was taking so long to respond to the Productivity Commission's recommendations, which included a call to remove basic religious charities, BRCs, Treasurer Jim Chalmers said that the government had announced it would implement two key recommendations. However, neither of these changes relate to recommended reforms of religious charities that the Productivity Commission argued would enhance regulatory consistency and public transparency. In early September, Senator David Shoebridge submitted a question on notice asking the government about when it would provide a response to the Productivity Commission's Future Foundations for Giving report and why it was taking so long. The Productivity Commission handed its report to the government on the 10th of May 2024, and the report was later released to the public on the 18th of July 2024. In response to the question on notice, Mr. Chalmers said, "The government announced in the 2024-25 MYEFO that it would implement from the Productivity Commission's final inquiry report, Future Foundations for Giving, the report," he said. The government continues to consider its response to the report's other recommendations. The reforms that the government has agreed to make relate to removing the condition that a gift to a deductible gift recipient be valued at $2 or more before the donor may claim a tax deduction, and aligning and increasing the minimum annual distribution rate for public and private ancillary funds. Upon the release of the report last year, the Assistant Minister and the responsible person for charities, Andrew Lee, swiftly rejected the recommendation that deductible gift recipient, DGR, status be removed for school building funds, despite the report showing such funds overwhelmingly benefited the wealthiest private schools. In recommending removal of the BRC category from the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, ACNC, Act 2012, the Productivity Commission said it could not identify a policy rationale that justifies retaining BRCs. BRCs, organisations with charity status for advancing religion, enjoy exemptions to the governance, standards and financial reporting requirements that apply to other charities, including religious organisations that do not have BRC status. It also recommended the removal of DGR status for religious education activities in government schools and all activities for the purpose of advancing religion. In two submissions to the Productivity Commission's inquiry in mid-2023 and in early 2024, the RSA said the exemptions enjoyed by BRCs undermined the integrity of the charity system and public trust. The RSA has since directly urged Dr. Lee to support the Productivity Commission's recommendations on BRCs. Religious lobbyists responded angrily to the Productivity Commission's recommendations, describing the Commission as having a clear anti-religion agenda and as having mounted a direct attack on faith communities. In August last year, the RSA reported that religious lobbyists were demanding the Albanese government continue to recognise faith-based charities as special and give them due respect. Back to you, Jane.
Thanks, Andy. So while private schools with their indirect as well as their direct funding has got money coming out of their ears and every way which way, public schools are still underfunded and it doesn't look too good for the future. Trevor Cobold has been crunching the figures once again, and here we have what is happening in South Australia. Over to Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. South Australian public schools get funding boost but remain underfunded. And this article was written by Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools and published on October 8. The claims by the Prime Minister, the South Australian Premier and Education Ministers that South Australian public schools will be fully funded by 2034 are a blatant lie. The new school funding agreement between the Commonwealth and the South Australian Government will not set public schools on the path to full funding, as government media releases say. Despite a substantial and very welcome boost in funding, South Australian public schools will remain underfunded in 2034, 23 years after the Gonski report recommended full funding. Public schools will remain very underfunded each year until 2034. It is a shameful neglect of the challenges facing public schools and the learning needs of disadvantaged students, the large majority of whom attend public schools. In 2034, South Australian public schools will be funded at 97.6% of their schooling resource standard, SRS, instead of 100%. Public schools will be underfunded by $120 million in 2034. Underfunding will increase from $373 million in 2024 to $402 million in 2028, before gradually declining to 2034. The cumulative underfunding over the 10 years is estimated at $3.1 billion. Public schools also suffered massive losses under the previous Morrison-era agreement. There are several reasons for the continuing underfunding. First, the Commonwealth increase in its share of funding public schools from 20% to 25% is only gradually phased in and is heavily backloaded to the last 5 years. Its share will only increase by 1.25 percentage points by 2029. The remaining 3.75% promised increase is left to the last 5 years. The increase over the first 5 years is estimated at $163 million and $318 million in the last 5 years. Second, the allowance for the South Australian Government to claim capital depreciation up to 4% of the SRS of public schools will not be removed until 2034. It will be reduced by only 1 percentage point by 2029, with the remaining 3% to be gradually reduced over the last 5 years. South Australian public schools will remain defrauded by this Morrison-era accounting trick for another 9 years. The cumulative loss of funding from this accounting trick will amount to $935 million. Third, the South Australian government can claim other non-SRS expenditure as part of its share of funding public schools. It can continue to claim expenditure on the Certificate of Education Board and the Education Standards Board. It can also claim up to 1.8% of the SRS for what the agreement admits are non-standard inclusions. It can now separately claim expenditure on school transport for public school students up to 1.07% of its SRS share for public schools to be phased in from 2026. A new allowance is that the government can also claim expenditure on the mid-year intake in public schools up to 0.73% of its SRS share. The funding loss for public schools from these non-SRS allowances will increase from $184 million in 2024 to $212 million in 2029, before reducing to $120 million in 2034. The funding agreement discriminates against public schools by allowing the South Australian Government to claim non-SRS expenditures as part of its share of funding public schools, but not for its share of funding private schools. Private schools are also subject to regulation, and private school students are eligible for school transport subsidies. Discriminatory defrauding public schools provides another resource advantage for private schools. The agreement must be revised to give public schools a better and fairer deal. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. The South Australian Government should remove the 4% allowance by 2029 and immediately remove new non-SRS expenditure claims as part of public school funding. Sounds like a good idea. I don't know if we'll see it. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks, Andy. But of course, because there's this underfunding of public schools, there's a lot of children who are falling through the cracks. And we have a phenomenon, a very interesting phenomenon. It's not an ideological one like it is in the United States. It's a practical solution to a problem which the government is failing to solve, the accidental homeschooling of children in Australia. And thanks to Andy for finding this article.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Catherine Gregory. Accidental homeschooling on the rise as families say schools are not coping. Homeschooling rates are rising rapidly, but the majority of growth has been among those considered accidental or unwilling homeschoolers. One father claims he's been driven to it out of necessity, as mainstream schools are simply not coping with bullying or neurodiversity. An emerging cottage industry of homeschooling businesses is now helping parents navigate the homeschooling system in their jurisdiction, build curriculums, teach and perform assessments. South Australia teacher Wayne Jeske never thought he would end up homeschooling his third child, but his daughter was just refusing to go to school even after trying several different ones. The anxiety was probably the biggest thing behind the school refusal, Mr. Jeske said. So it wasn't a not wanting to, it was really a not being able to situation. Mr. Jeske has great confidence in mainstream schools. His two older boys attended them, but he says they are mostly suited to neurotypical kids. Noisy classrooms, timetables, and teacher demands are not for everyone because there's a lack of agency that neurodiverse kids struggle with. I could see the impact it was having on her emotionally and on her well-being, Mr. Jeske said of his daughter. As a teacher, he'd seen firsthand how schools are trying but struggling to adapt classrooms for some neurodiverse children. He believes that is driving the huge growth in homeschooling, whereas a decade ago it was more of a philosophical choice. The people coming into it, like our family, they're more driven to it out of necessity, Mr. Jeske explained. Rebecca English estimates around 80% of homeschoolers are accidental or even unwilling. Education experts such as Rebecca English from the Queensland University of Technology estimates that the vast majority, about 80% of homeschoolers, are accidental or even unwilling. It's not actually a choice. They've run out of road, Dr. English said. She added that it's often because of bullying or neurodivergence or because the parents see that their child is a sort of square peg in a round hole. Parents take time out of the workforce to have to learn how to teach and also navigate what can be quite complex red tape to even register for homeschooling, particularly in New South Wales. A report last month by the New South Wales Auditor General found parents are waiting 65 working days or an entire school term for homeschooling applications to be processed, and the state government had failed to monitor student outcomes in alternative school settings with no set performance measures. A spokesperson for the New South Wales Education Department said it will accept all the report's recommendations and it was already prioritising strengthening support for homeschooling families after taking over the responsibility from the New South Wales Education Standards Authority, NESA, earlier this year. Primary school homeschooling registrations in Queensland grew by 110% from 2021 to 2025. In comparison, Dr. English said systems in Queensland, the ACT and Victoria work better because they are co-designed with parents, but overall support regulation and oversight of homeschooling needs to be improved across the country. Departments of Education don't really understand the issues faced by families that report feeling forced into homeschooling, she said. Dr. English estimated 20% of homeschool parents are teachers, which helps. Mr. Jeske said creating a curriculum has been relatively straightforward for him, but without that educational background, I think it's going to be a lot more challenging. They don't know how to navigate the bureaucracy of schools and homeschool applications and the rest of it, so they sort of go into it under-resourced and quite blind. Brisbane mother Sandy Whiteman started homeschooling her two neurodivergent children about 3 years ago due to bullying. She said she felt the school was not properly resourced to manage the needs of her children. I went through a very traumatic period, Ms. Whiteman said. I now prioritise the mental health of my kids. The children have now found their rhythm, and Ms. Whiteman, who was a stay-at-home mother, said homeschooling has been a powerful experience for all of them. The family follows what's called the unschooling approach, where the children are not forced to follow a set curriculum, but learn more through daily tasks, such as cooking and excursions. There are 10 to 15 types of curriculums and homeschooling styles, Ms. Whiteman explained. Mine is more of a mix and match. The Queensland Homeschooling Department is super supportive and flexible. Every year we have to do reporting and follow the curriculum styles. We still cover off English, maths and science. But a simple scroll of homeschooling Facebook pages reveals just how many questions parents have about curriculums, registering for homeschooling and assessments. That's why there's been what Dr. English calls an emerging cottage industry of homeschooling businesses, which helps parents navigate the homeschool system in their jurisdiction. They can range from relatively informal groups to something like a formal online private school, such as Crimson Global Academy. The senior admissions officer at the academy, Alexander Cork, said, "We help parents meet the homeschooling requirements of their respective states and territories. From there, the students can be assessed for university entrance as well." He explained the academy caters for families across the country, but while it's registered as a school in New Zealand and the US, it cannot be registered here because our education system is state-based. So it varies state by state as to what the requirements are, he said. In some states and territories, it's just as simple as doing some kind of maths and English. But in a state like New South Wales, it's usually a little bit more prescriptive. Australian schools will need to initiate action against a bullying complaint within 2 days of a reported incident as part of a new national plan to tackle bullying. He said most parents use the academy because their child is either bored in school or has fallen through the cracks at the school, often due to neurodiversity and bullying, and they feel they cannot be teachers themselves. In a statement, a spokesperson for Education Minister Jason Clare said a meeting of education ministers last week agreed to a national plan to address bullying, as recommended by the Anti-Bullying Rapid Review. Part of that was a $10 million investment in anti-bullying initiatives in schools and an awareness campaign. The Commonwealth will also provide $4.3 billion to schools this year in disability loading to help support neurodiverse children. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale and Andy, for that very interesting article from the ABC. But now we'll have a bit of a break.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because Dale has been doing some interesting research too in pearls and irritations. And here she's found this article about how the ALP outsourced the soul of higher education. Over to you, Dale.
Thank you, Jean. This is an article by John Frew from the Pearls and Irritation blog, titled How the ALP Outsourced the Soul of Higher Education. For most of its history, the Australian Labor Party spoke of education as a public good, the light on the hill, a vision of collective progress through strong institutions, universal access, and the elevation of ordinary citizens. Universities, like schools, were part of that public mission. They existed not merely to produce workers, but to expand minds, deepen culture, and strengthen democracy. Today, under a Labor government, the reality is starkly different. Across the country, universities are slashing courses, closing faculties, and shedding thousands of staff. At the University of Technology, Sydney, an entire education faculty has been suspended, with all primary and secondary teacher training degrees mothballed, just as New South Wales faces a chronic teacher shortage. The pattern is not accidental, but ideological. Disciplines that question, interpret, and humanise are being dismantled in favour of those that serve markets and metrics. In the name of efficiency, a Labor government is presiding over the slow asphyxiation of the public university, the very institution once entrusted to enlighten, not merely to produce. Vice-chancellors frame these decisions as unavoidable responses to financial strain. Yet behind the curtain, the real architects are not academics or public servants, but consultants. KPMG, PwC, Deloitte, EY, and Naus Group. These are the same firms Labor once condemned as the shadow state, hollowing out the Commonwealth bureaucracy. Now they sit inside university governance, drafting blueprints for mass redundancies and course closures. Consultants bring a particular worldview. It is not neutral or evidence-based advice. It is ideology, neoliberalism on steroids. In this paradigm, a course is viable only if it generates profit. A staff member's worth is measured by grant dollars won. A faculty's survival depends on how it benchmarks against competitors. Social need, training teachers, preserving languages, nurturing culture, simply doesn't count. At UTS, KPMG's $4.8 million plan proposed ranking academics by research income and drawing up a master list for redundancies. Teacher training programs were mothballed because enrolments were deemed inefficient, even as the state begged for more teachers. At ANU, Noose Group's million-dollar project Galileo sought $250 million in savings, treating whole schools of music, sociology, and political science as expendable. At Wollongong in Tasmania, humanities and language programs vanished, erased not by scholarship, but by spreadsheet. This is not classical neoliberalism, which at least paid lip service to choice or competition. The consultant model is corporate triage. Cut costs, shed unprofitable units, standardize everything to the median. What survives is not what the nation needs, but what the model deems cheapest. In opposition, Labor rightly attacked the coalition for outsourcing the brain of the government to the Big Four. It warned that billions spent on consultants had hollowed out the public service, weakened accountability, and ceded democratic control to private firms. Labor promised to restore strong public institutions led by public servants in the national interest. Yet, in government, Labor has embraced the same paradigm in higher education. Universities are statutory bodies, funded, regulated, and accountable to the Commonwealth, not free-floating corporations. But the new generation of vice-chancellors bears little resemblance to the scholar leaders who once defined the university's intellectual character. Increasingly, they are professional administrators, career managers drawn from government, media, and the corporate world. Their expertise lies not in scholarship or pedagogy, but in budgets, branding, and organisational transformation. Mark Scott at the University of Sydney is emblematic, a consummate bureaucrat whose career spans the ABC and the New South Wales Department of Education, yet without a substantive record in research or teaching. Across the sector, the modern Vice-Chancellor is less an academic visionary than a chief executive, fluent in managerial jargon and performance metrics, presiding over institutions whose missions have been rewritten in the language of markets. And when these Vice-Chancellors hire KPMG or Noose to design the very cuts that close faculties, gut research and collapse teacher training pipelines, Labor does little more than shrug. Nowhere is the contradiction sharper than in teacher education. The Albanese government trumpets its National Teacher Workforce Action Plan. Scholarships, internships, more funded places. Jason Clare repeats that Australia cannot fix its schools without training more teachers. Yet at UTS, the consultants' spreadsheets prevailed and teacher education was mothballed. The New South Wales Labor government pleaded with the university to reconsider. It didn't. What does it say when a Labor government offers scholarships with one hand while allowing universities to abolish the very courses those scholarships would fund? It says the rhetoric of public service is intact, but the substance has been outsourced. The consultant paradigm now dominates not just restructures, but governance itself. Noose alumni occupy senior executive roles at Griffith. Big Four partners sit on university councils. At least one in three Australian universities has a consultant or ex-consultant in its governing body. The advisors have become the governors. This creates a closed loop. Consultants are hired to diagnose a financial crisis. They draft the cost-cutting plan, embed staff to implement it, then return later to review progress. Millions flow out in contracts. Thousands of academic jobs disappear. When challenged, vice-chancellors insist on independent advice. But independence is fiction. These firms are paid to deliver the outcome management already wants. As one academic put it, consultants don't provide analysis, they provide cover. Labor's founders saw the light on the hill as a beacon of hope that every generation should be better off, more educated, more equal than the last. Today, under a Labor government, the only light in higher education seems to be the glow of a consultant's PowerPoint slide. The irony is bitter. Labor still speaks of public good, but allows universities to be remade as corporations. It still decries consultant dependencies in the bureaucracy, yet always looks away as the same firms dismantle our universities. It still promises to fix the teacher shortage, even as it permits faculties that train teachers to vanish. This is not mere inconsistency. It is betrayal, a surrender of purpose disguised as reform. The party that once championed universal education now presides over its hollowing. The light on the hill has dimmed, refracted through a balance sheet where profit has become the only public virtue. If Labor wishes to reclaim its moral authority, it must break with the consultant paradigm, rebuild public governance, fund socially vital disciplines, and restore universities as places of learning, not revenue streams. Until then, its words ring hollow. The light on the hill was never meant to be an accountant's lamp. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. And the hot topic of the moment, of course, is AI, artificial intelligence. Actually, we should just call it automation. We are in a technological revolution. But how are Australian schools using this? Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. How Australian schools are using AI in 2025? And this was written by Brett Henneberry and published in The Educator on the 20th of October. According to the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, AI literacy is now a must-have in education as the technology both advances and proliferates quickly throughout organizations worldwide. LinkedIn's 2025 Skills on the Rise report revealed that AI literacy is Australia's most sought-after skill, highlighting a dramatic surge in demand that has reshaped hiring trends nationwide. With a 240% jump in AI-related hires nationwide since 2016, and soft skills such as communication, strategic thinking, and adaptability becoming indispensable, schools face a pivotal challenge, equipping students with both the technical know-how and human-centric skills necessary to thrive in an AI-driven workforce. The good news for Australian schools is that our teachers are already among the highest users of AI. The OECD's latest Teaching and Learning International survey, TALIS, shows about two-thirds, 66%, of Australia's lower secondary teachers reported using AI in the past year, ranking Australia as the fourth highest country within the OECD and far above the OECD average of 36%. How are Australian teachers using AI? Of Australian teachers who used AI, the most common purposes were brainstorming lesson plans and learning about and summarising content. This was happening for 71% of Australian teachers who used AI. Australian teachers were unlikely to use AI to review data on student performance, 9% of those who use AI, compared to 28% across the OECD, and to assess student work, 15%, compared to 30% across the OECD. In an article published in The Conversation, Professor Robin Shields, who is the head of the School of Education at the University of Queensland, said teachers are embracing AI but remain cautious due to privacy concerns and the need for professional judgment. Australian teachers are global leaders in their use of AI, but much work needs to be done to improve teachers' wellbeing at work, Professor Shields wrote. Sustaining the teaching profession and the quality of teachers' work is a key national priority. More careful analysis of these results can help guide this work. Can AI improve learning? In a recent op-ed, Professor Claire Wyatt-Smith of Wyatt-Smith Education Solutions and Dr. Megan Kimber of Australian Catholic University's Institute for Learning Sciences and Teacher Education said that for teachers to harness AI, they must be literate, ethical, and creative in how they plan, teach, and assess. They need to be data literate, taking advantage of AI tools to monitor student learning over time to better see what they need to teach next, Professor Wyatt-Smith and Dr. Kimber wrote. Beyond this, teachers can share valuable learning data through longitudinal monitoring and individual digital learning histories. Teachers can use AI to improve education, but only when they are AI literate and human-centeredness remains fundamental to schooling. How to develop AI skills. While a big focus for schools has been on equipping young people with the skills to thrive in the AI-driven workforce, one expert says students do not need an IT degree to effectively use and understand this technology. To become AI literate, Macquarie Business School Associate Professor Maurizio Moroni said students and parents need technical understanding, how AI works, its capabilities and limitations, practical skills, the ability to use AI tools, and ethical awareness, an understanding of the societal implications and ethical considerations of AI. Students and parents should seek out AI tools such as ChatGPT, OpenAI, Gemini, and Copilot for text generation. Try MidJourney, DALL-E, and Stable Diffusion for image creation, Professor Moroni said. Understand them by experimenting with different prompts, reading platform documentation, and completing introductory tutorials available on these platforms. Professor Moroni said AI literacy should be viewed as a complementary skill that enhances one's primary discipline rather than replacing it. Students in history, economics, and other disciplines should develop AI literacy skills that are relevant to their fields. AI literacy is becoming fundamental, regardless of one's specialisation, much like digital literacy. Back to you, Jane.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andy. And now Andy's going to take us over to America for a very interesting article. Over there, they're banning books. This anti-wokeism, this cultural revolution they're trying to manufacture over there means the banning of books. But it's not as easy as they think. Let's hear about it, Andy?
Thanks, Jane. Wyoming County just learned an expensive lesson about banning books. And this was published on October 14 and written by Rob Boston for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The leaders of a Wyoming county have just learned that banning books doesn't pay, literally. Terry Leslie, former director of the Campbell County Library System, was fired in 2023 after she refused to remove books with content about LGBTQ plus issues and human sexuality that offended some people in the area. Leslie chose not to go quietly. She filed a lawsuit against the county, alleging a hostile work environment and charging that the library board acted with malice and acted with reckless disregard of her rights. A separate section of her lawsuit raised church-state issues, asserting that the library board and county officials were trying to forge the library's collection in a way that endorsed or favoured one denomination of Christianity over other Christian denominations, other religious beliefs, and/or over non-religious beliefs. I do feel vindicated. The case was recently settled out of court, and Leslie, who had been at the library for nearly 20 years, will receive $700,000. I do feel vindicated. It's been a rough road, but I will never regret standing up for the First Amendment, Leslie said, reported CBS News. The story sounds familiar. A band of religious extremists decided that certain books shouldn't be in the library's collection. Among them, CBS reported, were LGBTQ-themed titles such as This Book is Gay by Juno Dawson, but also several volumes offering factual information about sex and dating, including How Do You Make a Baby by Anna Fisk, Doing It, Let's Talk About Sex by Hannah Witten, Sex is a Funny Word by Corey Silverberg, and Dating and Sex, A Guide for the 21st Century Teen Boy by Andrew P. Smiler. The First Amendment is alive and strong. Iris Halpern, Leslie's attorney, remarked, "We hope at least that it sends a message to other libraries, districts, other states, other counties, that the First Amendment is alive and strong and that our values against discrimination also remain alive and strong. These are public entities, they're government officials, they need to keep in mind their constitutional obligations." That's a message we need to hear right now as across the country, aggressive Christian nationalist groups step up their attacks on the freedom to access information, read and learn. As we noted on this blog last week, which was Banned Books Week, censorship organisations have pushed us to the crisis point. PEN America documented 6,870 instances of book bans during the 24-25 school year. In a recent report, the group called book banning rampant and common in America, adding, "Never before in the life of any living American have so many books been systematically removed from school libraries across the country. Never before have so many states passed laws or regulations to facilitate the banning of books, including bans on specific titles statewide. Libraries serve everyone. It's a national embarrassment, and it doesn't have to be this way. The folks in Campbell County and elsewhere need to learn a few simple lessons. Public libraries are exactly that, public. That means they will contain a range of materials designed to meet the needs of people from all walks of life. Some of this material may not be relevant to you. Some may even offend you. There's an easy answer. Don't read that stuff. And if it really bothers you, tell your children not to read it as well. The key words here are your children. As a parent, you have some say over what they see and read. You have absolutely no say over anyone else's child." And back to you, Jane.
Well, that's very interesting indeed. And we're going to stay overseas with our roaming expert, and this is Jeff. Let's hear from Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to talk about what's going on in the States again, but we're just going to do one article. We're going to talk about a RIF. Now, a RIF is a reduction in force. That's what they're doing in the Trump administration to the Education Department. Now, you may know already that the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, organised about 1,500 or 1,600 people made redundant recently when she first took over, and they've just sacked another 466. They got what they call a RIF, which is a reduction in force. This is an article. Appeared on the K-12 Dive, which is a education blog by Cara Arundel. And she says, "What to know about the Education Department's latest round of RIFs?" And she writes, "Experts warn of potential disruptions to the oversight of civil rights protections and funding reimbursements due to severe staff reductions in education. Even more than 400 US Department of Education staff has received reduction in force notices on Friday. many of these laid-off employees remain in the dark about their employment status. That's because they couldn't access their work emails to review the RIF notices, reduction in force, with the federal government as it shut down due to congressional impasse over funding. The RIFs impacted Education Department officers that oversee civil rights, special education, student achievement supports, budgeting services, school safety, post-secondary education and more, according to the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, a union representing more than 2,700 education employees in an October 12th email. The situation follows months of downsizing at the agency, which began the year with about 4,133 employees and is now estimated to be about 2,000 after Friday's RIF. The Education Department, however, has not provided details about the layoffs. Friday's mass layoffs have caused confusion, concern and anger among the public school professionals and advocacy groups. They worry the Education Department will not be able to carry out its statutory requirements with such a lean staff, which would in turn impact districts, schools and families. Some, however, say the agency needs to be trimmed and that less government red tape will give states and districts more freedom to budget based on their needs. Proponents of federal workforce downsizing laud the savings to taxpayers from reducing federal labour expenses. Here, we explain what you need to know about this situation. What happened? On October 10th, some 466 Education Department employees in various offices were to receive RIF notices, according to court documents filed by the White House's Office of Management and Budget. Across 30 federal agencies, including the Education Department, about 4,232 employees were expected to be laid off. When the federal government shut down October 1st because Congress could not agree on a budget for fiscal year 2026, the Education Department planned to furlough about 95% of its non-federal student aid staff for the first week, according to a September 28 memo from the US Education Secretary Linda McMahon. During the shutdown, the Education Department expected to pause grant-making activities, technical assistance support and Office for Civil Rights investigations. The ability of states and districts to draw down most federal grants would continue, as would the disbursement of student aid such as Pell Grants and federal direct student loans, according to the memo. Student loan borrowers would still be required to make repayments on their debt. McMahon's memo also said the agency would continue to process the free application for federal student aid. During the federal shutdown, furloughed employees are typically forbidden to work, including checking their email. They also don't receive pay, but in the past have received retroactive pay once the shutdown ends. According to an October 7th article from the Associated Press, the Trump administration said it may not issue back pay once the shutdown concludes. The Education Department's staff had already been downsized this year due to a large-scale layoffs in March, as well as buyouts and early retirements. The Trump administration has further sought to eliminate the Education Department to the extent possible through the program cuts and changes. These efforts have been challenged in court. Some labour unions and education professional organisations are also questioning the legality of the latest layoffs. These RIFs will double down on the harm to K-12 students, students with disabilities, first-generation college students, low-income students, teachers and local education boards, which are already feeling the impact of a hamstrung department from the March RIF, said AFGE Local 252 President Rachel Gittleman in an October 12 statement. The US Office of Personnel Management's RIF policy says an agency is required to use the RIF procedures when an employee is faced with separation or downgrading for a reason, such as a reorganisation, lack of work, shortage of funds, insufficient personnel ceiling, or the exercise of certain re-employment or restoration rights. OPM guidance issued late last month said agencies are allowed to issue the RIF notices during a government shutdown and that employees may access their work computers to check the status of the shutdown or for RIF notices, but apparently some Education Department employees didn't see the guidance before the government closed. What's the impact for kindergarten to 12 schools, K-12? public school advocates are raising alarms about the extreme downsizing at the education department. While they don't expect an immediate impact on most day-to-day activities of schools, they warn that the reduced levels of federal support will become more evident at local levels the longer the shutdown lasts and if agency staffing levels remain low. For instance, students with disabilities are still entitled to special education supports through individualised education programs, as guaranteed under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. States and districts are still required to comply with IDEA, but with only a handful of people working on federal special education oversight, the accountability system is in jeopardy, advocates said. As we understand it, these rifts affect all but a few staff and will harm students with disabilities, said Denise Marshall, CEO of the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, in an October 13th statement. The action sends the message that our children are not valued and unfairly creates confusion and chaos in our schools. Marshall added that decimating the Department of Education disrespects and ignores the requirements of IDEA. In an October 13 statement, AASA, the School Superintendents Association, expressed concerns about the department's ability to oversee discretionary funding, formula grants and competitive grants. The majority of staff in both the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education and the Office of Special Education Programs received RIF notices, and the two offices together are responsible for issuing about $44 billion annually, AASA said. There is a reason to be concerned that the Education Department cannot effectively manage this funding without many of these staff, and there could be disruptions to district and state operations, including reimbursement requests, AASA said. A broad coalition of more than 350 national, state and local disability, civil rights and education organisations on Tuesday issued a statement condemning the Education Department's firings, including those in the Office for Civil Rights. The coalition also specifically mentioned oversight of IDEA, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and Title 4 of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. Without personnel to oversee these laws, the department cannot provide essential leadership, oversight, guidance or support to states and schools, jeopardising students' access to free, appropriate public education and hampering the ability of states and localities to serve all students, the statement said. The National Association of Federally Impacted Schools said most of the Impact Aid Program staff are believed to be among those affected by the latest layoffs. The Impact Aid Program supports districts that lose property tax revenue because of tax-exempt federal property within their boundaries. If true, the loss of the IAP program analysts who process payments, provide technical assistance and ensure the programs run accurately and transparently would threaten the continuity and integrity of Impact Aid, with serious consequences for school districts, including those that serve large numbers of military-connected and Native American students, the group said on Monday's statement. Washington State Superintendent Chris Rydell said in a Monday statement that his office had not received any indication that federal funds are at risk for local school districts. The federal education grant system is active and entities are still able to draw funds, he said. And despite what's happening in Washington, D.C., Rydell said Washington State is committed to the civil rights protections of more than 155,000 students with disabilities served under IDEA. School districts in the state rely on $275 million in federal funding annually, according to Rydell. Rydell said Washington State has civil rights protections for students that go beyond the federal minimum protections, and the State Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction will continue to enforce those laws. He also said that the state legislature made significant bipartisan investments in special education in recent years. Still, he said, without federal special education staff available to perform audits, provide technical assistance and complete investigations, the layoffs remove several of the safeguards that the federal government has put in place, and the extent of the impacts to services for students and families is not yet known. What's happening in the courts? The American Federation of State, County and Municipal Employees, AFL-CIO, and many other unions are seeking temporary restraining orders to reverse the rifts across the federal government. A hearing on that request, which came in litigation originally filed against the OMB on September 30th in the US District Court in California, is scheduled for Wednesday. Meanwhile, while the US Supreme Court is taking up several cases in recent months regarding the Trump administration's efforts to fire federal workers. The justices, in an emergency decision in New York versus McMahon in July, allowed the Education Department's March 11 RIFs to take effect. Lower courts are also addressing the Education Department's staffing reductions, including a challenge to firing about half the staff at OCR earlier this year. Meanwhile, all eyes remain on Congress as to when the lawmakers may begin seriously to negotiate their way out of the spending impasse that is keeping the wheels of government from turning. And with that article, I'll say have a lovely weekend and wish you well back to the headquarters of the Dogs. Cheerio.
We have you still with us because we've been throwing quite a lot of very interesting, pretty meaty information at you. So I think it's time for a break before we come back to our good news story.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station.
Call 03-9419 8377 or sign up online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, I hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because we've got the good news now. There's been a landmark initiative to boost inclusive education in Australia's schools, and then we have our great state school. Once again, over to our stalwart, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Landmark Initiative to Boost Inclusive Education in Australia's Schools by Brett Hennebury, 20th of October 2025. A landmark initiative to boost inclusion for autistic students was launched at New South Wales Parliament House this Wednesday, the 22nd of October, bringing together more than 130 educators, researchers and policymakers from across the state's education sectors. Hosted by Parliamentary Secretary for Education and Early Learning, Greg Warren, MP, and addressed by Minister for Disability Inclusion, Kate Washington, MP, the event, Inclusion Through Collaboration, marks the launch of ASPECT's first community of practice for inclusive education. The new network, led by Autism Spectrum Australia, ASPECT, aims to strengthen inclusive teaching and learning across public, Catholic, independent and university settings. It follows urgent calls from both the Disability Royal Commission and the National Autism Strategy to improve access, equity and outcomes for autistic students through greater collaboration and shared expertise. Back to you, Jean.
That's great because public schools are about inclusive education. And here we have our Great State School of the Week.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's Great State School of the Week is Yarraville West Primary School. Great kids, great school. We are proud of our 130-year history in providing education. Yarraville West Primary School is at the very heart of the Yarraville community, and our alumni carries many names from a proud education history in the West. Our school is situated on the corner of Anderson and Powell Streets, Yarraville, adjacent to the expansive Yarraville Oval and close to the vibrant Yarraville Village. YWPS strives to build a community of learners who work collectively towards success for all. We aim to ensure that learning is relevant and applicable to our students. We promote resilience, persistence, and independent learning strategies to foster lifelong learning that capably prepares our students for the 21st century. We have talented, caring, and committed staff who bring a variety of skills, interests, and experience to the school. YWPS believes that the most profound learning occurs when there is a healthy relationship between teachers, parents, and students. We continuously look for ways to enhance our community engagement and connections. All teaching and learning at our school is centred around ensuring that children are supported socially and emotionally in order for them to flourish. Our school values, respect, resilience, integrity and creativity, are threaded through the curriculum and whole school activities. These values encourage students to make positive choices in their day-to-day learning and interactions with others. We focus on positive education, combining academic skills, social skills, emotional regulation and resilience. Social and emotional learning and our school values are explored through the use of a range of teaching strategies and resources appropriate to each year level. These are underpinned by the resilience, rights and respectful relationships learning materials, which are utilised in every classroom from prep to year six. In the classroom, students are given frequent opportunities to work with others, which helps to foster cooperation and teamwork. Teachers have collaborated to define the key principles of effective classroom management at our school. We believe in respect, organisation, consistency, routine, positivity, engagement, and high expectations. In the playground, we aim to reinforce positive relationships, which is supported by our school-wide positive behaviour matrix. There are a number of lunchtime activities, the buddy program, and teachers on yard duty to support students to solve problems and continue to build respective relationships across the school. And that's from the school's website. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The enrolment sits at 687, and the ICSEA value is above average, 1,146, representative of a diverse urban community. The upper 25% of parental incomes makes up 59% of students, and the second quartile, 28% of students. 11% of students have parents in the third quartile, and the lowest 25% of parental incomes make up 3% of students, with 17% speaking a language other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $2.2 million and the Victorian Government, $7.3 million. Private fees and contributions, $441,000, and other private contributions add $148,000. And that works out at $13,840 per student. The capital, $1 million over 3 years. This is a school doing an amazing job on very basic funding. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Yarraville West Primary School. And if you want to find out more about the dogs, you can at our website at www.adogs.info. But from Dale, our wonderful producer and her fellow helper, Andy, and from Jeff and from myself, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.